Lunar Science. Welcome to Lunar Science, the series in which we discuss the scientific investigation of the Moon and its environment in the Artemis era. The Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter is a spacecraft that has been orbiting the Moon since 2009. Its data, both in images and spectra, are being used to plan the future Artemis human missions and the unmanned CLPS missions. CLPS, C-L-P-S, is NASA's program in which they pay commercial providers for placing experiments on the Moon or in orbit around it. In May of 2022, Joelle Kearns gave an update on exploration science. Now, Joelle is Deputy Associate Administrator in NASA's Exploration Science Mission Directorate. He begins episode 33.
So within the time I have today, I wanted to focus on some more near-term activities to make sure you were aware of. First, I want to say congratulations to Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter for a successful senior review and going into their next extended mission. You know, Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, LRO, has been taking data so long since 2009, everyone in the communities have just learned to rely on them. And they of course, produced some amazing value to NASA, whether it's photo reconnaissance or other measurements that instruments are making. They're used from everyone doing research and analysis work to planning the upcoming crewed Artemis missions to planning the CLPS missions that are coming up. That I just wanted to take a minute to say thank you for the great job you were doing, and we look forward to your continued work coming up. I'm going to take most of the time that I have available just to give you an update on what's going on with commercial lunar payload services and the various instruments and instrument suites that are being prepared to fly to the Moon. An updated view of the 7 landings that have been contracted out by NASA to the CLPS providers take a variety of instruments, investigations, and instrument suites to the Moon. They're currently being provided by 4 different companies out of our group of 14 companies in our CLPS indefinite delivery, indefinite quantity pool. You can tell who's got which deliveries. They're listed here with their announced landing dates coming up from 22 to 25. You'll notice here, there are 3 here that don't have the delivery provider named. One of them is for Schrodinger Basin on Farside, which will go in 2025. Of course, the instrument suites for that were selected in the PRISM-1 competitive solicitation last summer. And the CLPS project is right now competing to get the provider who will take the Farside seismic suite and the Litmus instruments, as well as the previously selected Lucy instrument, down to Schrodinger Basin on the Farside. And we should know later this year who that provider will be. See, the next delivery site is for Grootheism domes. You're probably aware that the investigations and the instrument suites for the Grootheism domes delivery, as well as the later delivery to the South Pole, will be selected based on the PRISM-2 solicitation results. And the evaluations of those proposals is ongoing. And we're confident that NASA will make an announcement of which investigations and instrument suites those will be later this month. And then after that is announced, we will work with the CLPS project office to start selecting the actual CLPS providers that will provide the delivery service down to Gruithuisen zones in the South Pole in 2025. And there is a regular cadence, as you know, once PRISM 2 selectees are announced, we'll then start working on PRISM 3. And of course, once the PRISM 2 selectees are announced, as I said, we'll, the CLPS project office at JSC will work with NASA headquarters to select the providers for the next two delivery. Then once we eventually select PRISM 3, we'll select those providers and on every year for the foreseeable future coming up. So the first two deliveries to the moon, we expect to take place later on this year.
We now turn our attention to some of the specific science investigations to be done on the moon. One of the centers of attention are the permanently shadowed regions, often referred to as PSRs. In November of 2021, NASA scientist Caitlin Ahrens said that we should dig into the freezer at Amundsen Crater.
So this is exploring Amundsen Crater. So the interesting thing about Amundsen Crater is that it has a very interesting PSR region. So PSRs, just a brief explanation of PSRs, these are permanently shadowed regions. So typically under 150 Kelvin. In that case, just looking at this figure, an example site here, you would have some amount of sunlight, but really driving into the colder temperatures. So this area would typically have about 60 days worth of illumination over an 18-year cycle. But having a continuous under 100 Kelvin region in Amundsen can really allow for different kinds of volatiles, not just water ice, which is very exciting. So between 60 to 70 Kelvin, it's really good for something called volatile organic compounds, or VOCs, to potentially be stable at the surface and certainly at the subsurface, including formaldehyde. So interactions of the water ice and different kinds of organic molecules would certainly be an interesting drive toward PSR exploration. So some of our scientific objectives would obviously be, what is the nature of the volatiles present? What's the abundance besides just the function of temperature? What's the crystallinity? How do these volatiles behave between illuminated versus non-illuminated areas within Amundsen? Obviously, the measurement of the VOCs for astrobiological implications. How are these potentially the building blocks of an early solar system and certainly an early lunar surface? And then the obvious one is ground truths for Viper, for Trailblazer, and other planned polar missions. So what's exciting is that there's a plethora here of example traverses for PSRs, telerobotic traverses, and certainly a number of community white papers to better understand polar volatiles. So the obvious required capability is to work at extremely low temperatures, preferably under 100 Kelvin. And then also potentially in the dark. So you would need to have some sort of short traverse to go in between your light and dark regions quickly enough for communications, but then also traverse back into a dark, deep PSR. Another interesting instrument to be required for the VOCs would be mass specs. So something similar to the Mars Organic Molecule Analyzer. So such a mission would certainly have some sort of in situ measurements, but also potentially sample return. But the challenge with sample return would certainly be some sort of cold storage, and that could certainly be up for discussion later. Some enhancing capabilities would certainly be diving deeper into the traverse. So in that case, you would still have a much darker, non-illuminating areas, but trying to get into the colder temperatures, what kind of more organics can you have? The colder you are, the more hydrogen sulfides, ammonia type ices that you can have there as well. And then could there also be potential for rover and penetrator type sciences involved? So it's not just a deeded lander, but also could you have an array of smaller instruments at these PSRs. So very exciting science we're potentially at Amundsen Crater. Thank you.
When Celine Dion sang, What do I have to do? Get water from the moon? In order to win the love of her man, the moon was viewed as a dry world devoid of any water. Since then, discoveries have been made to make Selene's task possible. In November of 2020, the Glenn Research Center's Julie Kleinhans recounted what we now know about lunar water. Oh, and by the way, ISRU stands for In Situ Resource Utilization. That means using the water found on the moon for more than sparking a love interest.
It's great. We've identified water on the moon, but water has been identified as a resource, but its potential use for ISRU really requires identifying and locating a reserve. And I'll talk a little more about that definition as we go forward. But we really need to start to understand that the water content is a function of depth and distribution, the physical form, and even things like the geotechnical characteristics of the over material and the material itself. So this study was really focused on trying to bring that all together and see what we need to really move from saying, yay, we found water, to yes, there's water that we can use, and this is where you go to get it. We identified four water sources on the lunar surface, those being surface frost, shallow bulk water, deep bulk water, and pyroclastic deposits. Of those, and given the ISRU current criteria, the best option was the shallow bulk water, where we're kind of defining that as down to a meter, maybe two. The other ones didn't have the tonnage or characteristics that we would need for ISRU. So of those, the data sets that we have, you can, LCROSS is our only kind of surface measurement or ground truth kind of measurement. The rest of the data is CPR radar and neutron count data. So, you know, there's limitations, as you all probably know better than I do, on water equivalent hydrogen. You can't get accurate concentrations unless you know the distribution. And so there's a lot of uncertainty in that data still, and a lot of uncertainty in the resolution as well. And radar data is great, but it also has, can suggest surface roughness and some other, so you really need a secondary data set and be able to interpret that. So the bottom line is the current data set of knowledge we have for shallow bulk water is really insufficient to define an ISRU reserve. So, and the current instruments and vantage points of those instruments were designed with science objectives in mind, not ISRU, and there's a subtle difference. But in order to define a reserve, you have to kind of establish the criteria for that reserve, right? Or the use case. So this line, I'm not going to spend much time, but this is where we started defining those. So it's not just the ISRU aspect and the tonnage and the lateral availability and the depth variability, but it's also the proximity to the user, right? The human landing site system. So all this fits into how you would want to go about locating and defining the reserve. Of course, orbital measurements are always important. They're always feeding in different interpretations, different data sets to get those regional and global data sets. But the ground measurements are what we need to verify the interpretation of those data sets, right? And really know what we're seeing. So that includes, we had three different type of landed missions that we identified, starting with type one, which would be Viper and Prime, that may not be necessarily going to a site that we think is an ISRU reserve, but it's going to a location to help us get the data we need to interpret the orbital data sets and build the model and get that range. Type two would be more focused on, okay, we think there's water here, let's just go try to verify that. And that could be a very simple mission, even like a penetrator, an impactor, or something like that. And then type three is what you do before you actually go there and build something, and that's fully mapping the deposit and doing the reserve mapping. Because these reconnaissance missions are going on, and the time frame of when we want to implement ISRU kind of overlap, we have to do technology development while we're doing the reconnaissance and prospecting.
Celine Dion is not the only Canadian with an interest in lunar water. Miriam Lamelin of Canada's University of Sherbrooke made some suggestions in October of 2020 for some lunar traverses that could prospect for water ice that Celine so desperately needs. One place to explore would be the PSRs, the permanently shadowed regions of the moon.
So as you all know, the robotic exploration of the lunar south polar region and the ground truthing of polar volatiles is one of the next steps of our NASA Artemis program, which aims to return humans to the moon by 2024 with the support of other space agencies and private companies. Other space agencies are also planning their own missions. So as a result, approximately 2 landers or rover will reach the lunar surface per year, starting next year in 2021. So while several remote sensing measurements made since the 1990s have implied the presence of water ice in the lunar south polar region, it's only in 2018 that the first unambiguous regional, yet spatially resolved, detection of surficial water ice was achieved using the Moon Mineralogy Mapper data. It revealed that surficial water ice is present in many permanently shaded regions. So knowing this, how do we decide on which PSRs should be visited by upcoming missions from a scientific, an ISRU, and from an engineering perspective? So that's our big question. So we created a database containing a maximum of valuable information for each of the water ice bearing PSRs that are known to date. And we use this database to evaluate PSRs of interest, given different potential mission goals and constraints. So we identified high priority sites for future exploration missions as sites that would allow to address more than one of the following goals. So for example, sampling the highest concentration of volatiles, characterizing the lateral distribution of volatiles, characterizing the lateral and vertical distribution of volatiles. So in terms of the vertical distribution, we mean water ice, H2O, and dry ice, CO2. And obtaining the fastest recovery of a scientifically interesting sample. We then derived the case study for 3 of the high priority sites that we have identified for 3 different traverse lengths. So a short mission that's between 20 and 50 kilometers in length, a medium mission that's about 100 kilometers long, and a longer traverse mission that's about 300 kilometers long. So first, to identify water ice bearing PSRs, we use the location of PSRs that's been derived from the LOLA data, so illumination models. And we use the surficial water ice detections from M-cubed. So we looked for sites that were both PSRs and had at least one surficial water ice detection in it. And then we characterized all these water ice bearing PSRs using a variety of remote sensing data sets. So we calculated, for example, the number of surficial water ice detections from M-cubed in each of the water ice bearing PSRs. We calculated the temperature regime using the Wiener data, so the minimum, maximum, and average annual temperatures. We calculated also the slope axis, both inside and outside the PSR using LOLA data. We calculated the hydrogen content using lunar prospector data, the model thermal stability of H2O and CO2 in the top meter of the regolith from Ziegler et al. 2016, as well as the age of some of the PSRs that's been derived by Deutsch et al. 2020.
Pascal Lee from the Mars Institute gave a talk in October of 2020 advocating for science to be done in extreme environments, such as those permanently shadowed regions, one of which is Shackleton Crater.
So today I'm going to talk about the science in extreme environments on the moon and why that actually should be a driver of our mobility requirements. So there are 2 extreme environments that I'd like to talk about in a relative sense. So these are extreme environments in a relative sense. It's bad enough to be on the moon, but there are places that even are worse in terms of environmental constraints than the average sort of lunar surface conditions. The permanently shadowed regions, and then high latitude candidate pits and caves, which we also would like to explore. The PSRs, of course, are extreme environments. They have low solar power or none, extremely low temperatures, unknown terrain, at least not at the scale of the wheelbase of our vehicles. The comms, of course, are potentially really difficult from inside the PSRs as well. And among the PSRs, including the ones that were just announced yesterday at the microscale, the very large PSRs, the ones that are tens to hundreds of kilometers across, are, in my view, of really high priority or great importance. because they are super cold traps. Paul Hain and others have pointed out that they are places where temperatures can drop to below 55 Kelvin, which is well past, of course, the freezing point of water, but also of carbon dioxide being exposed at the surface. And what we really want to do, if we want to characterize these volatiles properly, is to get to exposed volatiles. We're interested in things like their surface textures, because by being able to understand the surface of these exposed volatiles, we will be able to tell a lot about deposition conditions, whether they're being actively accumulated or lost. The thanks to in particular work by Mark Robinson and Robert Wagner, we now know of several hundred pits on the moon. They are mostly collapsed features that essentially are leading into a subterranean cavity. They are really important places from the standpoint of having access to exposed geology. Bedrock and layering in the lunar surface materials are well exposed on the walls of these pits. And of course, the cavities themselves are microenvironments where you have low power, low temperatures, unknown terrain, and no comms once you're inside the pit. Among these pits that we have on the moon, the ones of greatest interest to me at least are the ones that are at very high latitude. And we can't confirm that they are pits, but we have several candidates that we've been mapping out, including some that I've just published with a student, Winnie Vent II. We have a poster out about new candidate high latitude pits in Anaxagoras and Philolaus crater on the moon at 72 or 75 degrees north. Point about these high latitude pits is that they are also special cases of PSRs. They would be cold trapping volatiles as well. They would, in other words, they should be, and they would be, of course, very exciting to explore. So the scale of exploration is another fact. Lately, it relies on three key criteria to classify lunar terrain in terms of their H2O content or mode of exposure. The whether or not hydrogen is detected within the top 1 meter. So this is usually from orbital data, and we've been using Sannin et al.'s 2017 data. Whether or not you're located inside a PSR. So what's quite remarkable is, of course, there are hydrogen signatures within the top meter in the lunar polar regions that are not inside PSRs. And that's, of course, something we really have to understand. So we've been using Masurico et al.'s papers from 2011. And then there's also thermodynamic modeling of the depth, which allows water ice to be stable within the top, 1 or 2.5 meters of the regolith. And it's mostly Ziegler's work from 2018. So the point here is we have a simple, but at the same time important, I think, classification system in terms of guiding us to different terrain classes that we must try to target in order to understand this full picture of why there is water ice in the polar regions, whether or not it's actively accumulating or being lost, what is its history. All of these six classes of terrain really need to be explored and understood. And they're typically 1 to 10s of kilometers in scale and 10s of kilometers apart. And so this is one requirement yet for also mobility, which is going to be range. Places like Shackleton are going to be very difficult to explore. It's PSR in particular, because the crater is 4 kilometers deep and the slopes are near angle of repose in many places. So anywhere from 20 to 30, 33 degrees. So key thing, we need robust mobility on 10 to 30 plus kilometer scales. And in terms of exploring PSRs and pit caves, we need to be able to have repeated, deep, rapid insertion and extraction mobility. So in terms of robotic systems, I've been working with JPL on this concept called Globetrotter, which is essentially a hopper surrounded by an elastic cage, which allows it to really traverse quickly, rapidly, even extremely rough terrain. So this could be a precursor to human missions to a site or a robotic assistant to humans once humans are at a site. You could send one of these things down into Shackleton Crater and it could reach the bottom very quickly and, of course, do measurements and imaging along the way. But you could also explore a cave with it by plopping it down into a pit and then it could take measurements. Beyond the moon, of course, this approach has promises for Mars, for places like Phobos and Deimos. So again, this is a thrusted hopper surrounded by an elastic cage.